Last week, we looked at the difference between resolve and preparation in the Garden of Gethsemane, where the disciples, especially Peter, gave us the example of the hollowness of human resolve when he said, and they all agreed, "Even if I should die with you, I will not deny you." And in contrast, we saw what real preparation looks like in Jesus' anguish prayer: "My Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." And Jesus, through that time of preparation in the garden, gained what he needed that would carry him through the actual suffering of his passion. But the disciples, they were just basically waiting to be knocked down in their human resolve. They had promised that they would die with Christ rather than forsake him or deny him, and yet they couldn't even stay awake 1 hour to watch with him in his greatest need. They mistakenly believed that they could remain faithful through the exercise of their will. In other words, their trust was in willpower. We're going to look at four kinds of power today. Three of them are not real power. They're the kinds of power, they're kinds of power that we reach for to make us feel like we have power, to make us feel. We all want to feel strong. We want to feel capable. We want to feel that we have what it takes to meet the things that we know are coming down the road. So there's three kinds of power that we reach for, and Jesus rejected all of them, and we'll see how. And there's a fourth kind of power that Jesus had that is our example of the real power that it takes to pass through trials faithfully and to the glory of God. And the first kind that we're going to look at is this willpower, which ties into what we looked at last week with respect to resolve, but I want to go a little deeper into it and looking specifically at what Peter said. So back in verse 33 of Matthew 26, Peter answered him, "Though they all fall away because of you, I will never fall away." Jesus said to him, "Truly, I tell you, this very night, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." Peter said to him, "Even if I must die with you, I will not deny you." So you notice twice he uses these words, "I will." That's the exercise of the human will. I am determined. I have set myself on this piece of ground. I am not yielding it. Through the exercise of my will, I'm going to make this happen. I was thinking about a movie from years ago, a Disney movie, called Iron Will. And this is maybe one of the best examples of the kind of movie that I think especially guys really like, because it's the story of this young man who, in order to save the family farm, he goes on a 500-mile dog sled race in the dead of winter. We're talking 20, 30 degrees below zero. They're supposed to go 500 miles in about 10 days. And just everything in the world happens to him. And by the time he gets to the finish line, he's almost dead. But he gets the nickname Iron Will because his name is Will. And he just keeps pushing through and he kind of becomes a hero. And of course, he wins the race, being a Disney film. What I didn't know until I looked it up is that it's actually based on a true story. The guy was a little bit older. He was 26. He was from Boston. And he was very much of an underdog. The other racers were like Canadians and half Native American, and they were a lot more used to the rigors of this kind of a journey than he was. He kind of got to be a hero just because everybody liked his determination and how hard he tried. The interesting thing is he actually lost the race in real life. He came in last. So it kind of shows the difference between what we imagine is capable with the power of will and what we are really capable of. And even more tragically, the real-life character went to war, World War I, survived the war until the armistice, and then died immediately after when his observation plane crashed. And human life is so fragile. And really, if you look at what we're capable of as humans against the even just the power of nature, it's pretty small. I mean, it's true that you can do more than you think, and determination can accomplish a lot. But still, the limitations are really there are very great limitations on what we're capable of as human beings. And those limitations are not just external. It's not just that the world shows us how small and incapable we are. We ourselves very often limit ourselves through the defects of our character. Very often our limitations are internal and not external. However much we may resolve, however much we may try to exercise willpower, the psychologists will actually tell you today that most of them will tell you that there actually is no such thing as willpower. That it's just it's a delusion, basically, that we tell ourselves that we have. I don't know that I agree with that. But I do believe that we greatly overestimate, in some cases, what we can do, especially where we're trying to overcome the defects of our own character. Paul actually speaks about this in Romans chapter 7. If you want to turn there. And his diagnosis of the carnal man is pretty dismal. Even speaking in the first person, I mean, this is one of the most disciplined and faithful men who ever lived. A guy who literally went through near-death experiences multiple times and suffered untold hardships for the sake of the gospel. This is what he says in Romans chapter 7, beginning in verse 15. For I do not understand my own actions. For I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate. Now, if I do what I do not want, I agree with the law that it is good. So now it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells within me. For I know that nothing good dwells in me, that is in my flesh. For I have the desire to do what is right, but not the ability to carry it out. For I do not do the good I want, but the evil I do not want is what I keep on doing. Now, if I do what I do not want, it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells within me. So Paul is acknowledging, I have a will, and because of the new birth and regeneration, I desire to do what pleases God, but yet I find myself doing the opposite. We've all been there. We have all had the experience of desiring to do the will of God and finding ourselves doing the opposite instead. So we should know from those experiences that relying on willpower to accomplish any goal, let alone the goal of trying to please God, which is against our very nature, is a fast track to failure. We will fail exactly as the disciples did, probably even worse than they did, when they all pledged themselves to follow Jesus to death, and then in the garden they fell asleep, and as we'll see a few minutes later, after waking up, they ran. So willpower doesn't cut it. If anyone had the ability through the power of his own will to have been faithful, it would have been Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Because he was perfect in the sense that he was sinless, he had no sin nature working against the desires of his will to do the Father's will. But we do not find him relying on willpower. We do not find him saying to the Father, I will be faithful. I will go to the cross. Instead, what did he say when he prayed? It's the very, in a sense, the very opposite. He said, Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. We find him rejecting willpower as a power to enable him to do what he was called by the Father to do. We find him surrendering his will to the Father's will. And we'll get more into that later. So, moving on in the passage, after the disciples wake up, verse 46, Jesus says, Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand. While he was still speaking, Judas came, one of the 12, and with him a great multitude, a great crowd with swords and clubs from the chief priests and the elders of the people. I want to stop there just because this gives a pretty good picture of the second kind of power that human beings reach for to try to bolster ourselves, and that is physical power. It is the power of having a big crowd and a lot of weapons. And once again, this is kind of a guy thing. I think guys tend, now I'm not one that is big into this, but I can sense the appeal. We tend to like guns, for instance. And I'm not saying it's wrong to like guns. I think guns are a fine hobby if you're careful and you respect the power of it. But part of the problem of having a big collection of weapons is that it can make us feel more powerful than we are. Judas, when he came to betray the Son of God, came with a big crowd and a lot of weapons because it made him feel powerful, because it made those who were coming against Jesus feel more powerful that they had all of this military might, as it were. The interesting thing about military power, if you look at the whole history of God's people, especially in the Old Testament, is that the largest military powers were generally on the losing side of the great Old Testament battles. It was actually those who had less power that tended to be favored by God. He tended to use those who were the underdogs, so to speak. And probably the best example of this is the story of Gideon. He faced a horde of Midianite raiders who were not even countable, according to the scripture. And Gideon amassed an army of like 32,000 guys and probably expected God to say, wait a while, you could probably recruit 10 or 20,000 more. Instead, God said, your army is too large, so we need to downsize it. And through a series of purges, God got his army down to 300 men, who mostly ended up winning the battle with torches and trumpets rather than with their military hardware. Because God does not share his glory, and this is how he explained it to Gideon, Judges 7:2, the people with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hand, lest Israel boast over me, saying, my own hand has saved me. So when God wants to work, he very often removes a lot of the physical power so that we make no mistake about where the real power came from. Jesus Christ, who once again moved in the greatest power ever known to humanity, so far as we know, never picked up a weapon, never tried to build his following. We're going to look at that later. But he didn't come with a great crowd and a lot of physical power. He humbled himself into the weakness of humanity and didn't try to bolster himself with external things. Not so, unfortunately, his disciples are a little more confused about it. Reading on, verse 48, now the betrayer had given them a sign, saying, the one I will kiss is the man. Seize him. And he came up to Jesus at once and said, greetings, Rabbi, and he kissed him. Jesus said to him, friend, do what you came to do. I think this is such a beautiful example of Jesus' humility and his yieldedness to the Father. Imagine how many things he could have said to Judas in that moment. I mean, this is the Son of God who had perfect wisdom and could have just cut him down. And all he said was, called him friend, even though he knew he was there to betray him. Friend, do what you came to do. It was perfect yieldedness. It was not trying to have the last word or retaliate in any way. He was just yielded to his Father's will. You're here to do this, so do it. Then they came up and laid hands on Jesus and seized him. And behold, one of those who were with Jesus stretched out his hand and drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. So Matthew is nice and does not disclose who exactly this was. John tells us it was Peter, not too surprisingly. And here, you can't fault Peter for a lack of physical courage. I don't know how many of the disciples were armed. Probably not all of them. They were certainly not fighting men. They were fishermen. But he was up against, it says, a great crowd with swords and clubs. I mean, I'm sure, militarily speaking, they were outmatched. This was basically a suicide mission. What Peter probably thought was going to happen was one of two things. Either God was going to supernaturally enable him and whoever else among the disciples was capable of fighting to wipe out the whole detachment or to rout them, as happened in the Old Testament sometimes, or he was going to die right there. They were going to kill him fighting for Jesus. And apparently he was kind of okay with either one of those. It's interesting how we will sometimes sacrifice for God on our own terms. but not on his. So we might be willing to die for Christ, we might not be willing to live for Christ. Or we might be willing to die for Christ in one way, but not in another way. We might be willing to make this sacrifice, but not that one. We might be willing to go out in a blaze of glory, but not to humble ourselves before someone we can't stand. Sometimes that's harder. And it was a lot harder for Peter, because you can see here that he had physical courage. I mean, he was ready to take his sword and just go to it. And it's like, I'm going to die right here. But that wasn't how it was going to go. That wasn't God's will. Peter was moving in Peter's will. Once again, in the willpower that takes hold of physical power. I have a sword. I can do this. I can fight. I can die right here, right now. He didn't have the power that he needed to do God's will. He only had the power to do Peter's will. And Jesus called a halt. Verse 52, then Jesus said to him, "Put your sword back into its place, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword. Do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father, and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels? But how then should the scriptures be fulfilled that it must be so?" Just as he refused to rely on willpower, Jesus rejected the physical power that was available to him. Not only the rather overmatched physical power that was available to him from his disciples, who were, at least Peter, willing to fight, but he also said, look, if physical power were what were needed here, I could just ask the Father and he would send 12 legions of angels. Some people have pointed out there would have been one legion for Jesus and one legion for each of his disciples. A Roman legion was 6,000 men. Okay, so we're talking 72,000 angels, and I'm sure that that was not a hard limit by any means. Jesus was so confident in his Father's protection and in his Father's sovereignty that he did not doubt for a moment. All he had to do was say the word, and he would have had all the physical power he needed. But physical power was not what was needed to accomplish God's will in that moment, and therefore Jesus rejected it. He rejected Peter's attempts to use the power of weapons to accomplish his supposed protection. I want to, just since we're talking about physical power, I want to at least say a few words about pacifism, because this is kind of a thorny issue. If you look at this, Jesus says, and it sounds like a pretty broad statement, all who take the sword will perish with the sword. And some people point to this as an argument for pacifism. Christians can't ever make use of weapons or physical power under any circumstances. Using physical force or violence is just inconsistent with being a follower of Christ. I don't believe that that is what this passage intends to teach. D.A. Carson goes so far as to say, to even ask the question is to ask this text something that it's not really, it's not there. You know, this is not what this is trying to teach. I think we do have to deal with the question, deal with the argument. One thing I see in this, though, I think it was actually Carson who pointed this out. Jesus didn't say to Peter, throw your sword away. You don't need that. He said, put your sword back in its place. So it would seem that weapons and the use of physical force may have a place in the lives of followers of Christ. We're not told precisely what that is. Paul does say in Romans, he's speaking of the authorities, the authorities delegated by God, Romans 13:4, he says, but if you do wrong, be afraid, for he, that is the power, the authority, the governor, whoever, he does not bear the sword in vain, for he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. So Paul does speak of those who are God's servants who bear the sword, and there's a legitimate purpose for that. So we can't. I don't think we can put it in the category of it's always wrong to pick up a sword, gun, whatever, in every case whatsoever. I did wonder if there was something to be found in the phrase "take the sword." When Jesus said, "All who take the sword will perish with the sword," you can't get anything out of it linguistically. I tried. It's the word "take" is just simply "take." I mean, it could mean a wide variety of things. However, where I found myself going with it, and this is pretty much just my opinion, but maybe it'll stimulate your thinking about it. What I thought about is where Jesus said in his call to discipleship in Matthew 16:24, he said, if you want to follow me, you must take your cross. And The cross, not the sword, is what is supposed to define our lives as followers of Christ. It's kind of interesting. In the Middle Ages, when Crusades were all the rage and Europeans were going to the Middle East to try to liberate the Holy Land, it was called taking the cross when they made a vow that they were going to go to the Holy Land and to fight in these Crusades. But they weren't really taking the cross, because the cross is death to self, not death to someone else. The sword would symbolize death to someone else, and there may be an appropriate use of that if a Christian is acting as a God-delegated authority. But the cross means death to me. And that is the symbol of our discipleship. The symbol of following Christ. What is supposed to define our lives is not the power of the sword to destroy someone else. It's the power of the cross to destroy the old man, to destroy the carnal man. And so I think when Jesus is talking about taking the sword, I think what he's really talking about is relying on the sword. I think he's talking about having that be the thing that we reach for in order to do our own will, whereby we are drawn into violence and become subject to that violence. And it is cyclical. I mean, if you look at the violence in our country today, generally speaking, nothing is being solved. As is most often the case, or perhaps always the case, when it's not God-ordained authorities using physical force, it tends to just escalate. It tends to get worse and worse. Because if you attack someone, they attack you back, and so on and so forth it goes. And I think that's the kind of thing that Jesus is talking about. But Peter here was not acting according to God's will and commission. He was acting according to his own will, what he thought was right in the situation. And Jesus said, that's not what we want to do. Take the sword that way, you'll perish by the sword. Verse 55, at that hour, Jesus said to the crowds, "Have you come out against a robber with swords and clubs to capture me? Day after day, I sat in the temple teaching, and you did not seize me. But all this has taken place that the scriptures of the prophets might be fulfilled." Then all the disciples left him and fled. One of the problems with willpower is that it often fails us when the path takes a turn we weren't expecting. You can psych yourself up for certain things, and you can imagine, I'm going to face this challenge and that challenge, and this is how I'm going to power through. There was a case of a guy who set out to walk across the entire United States, and he ended up giving up because of sand in his shoes. I don't think that was the thing that he thought would ultimately derail his efforts, but it was something that just he couldn't find a way to, deal with that problem, and it just wore him down to the point that he finally gave up. And that's the problem, is that our willpower often is focused on just what we can see, and we often have tunnel vision. And to the disciples, what they saw ahead of them was this maybe a glorious martyrdom, fighting like the Maccabees, you know, against the Roman or whoever it was, physically with their swords, and they would die that way. But Jesus took a turn that they were not expecting, and essentially said, this is the Father's will for me to yield myself to what's happening. And they weren't prepared for that. That knocked them for a loop. The idea that they were just going to surrender and allow the bad guys to win, I mean, that was what it looked like in that moment. And that was where their willpower failed. And they did the very thing they said they would not do. They forsook him. They'd said they would die with him first, but it crumbled. It was hollow. There was nothing on the inside. The willpower and the physical power failed. And Jesus had already rejected them both. He was moving in a different power. Verse 57, then those who had seized Jesus led him to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders had gathered. And Peter was following him at a distance, as far as the courtyard of the high priest, and going inside, he sat with the guards to see the end. Now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking false testimony against Jesus that they might put him to death. But they found none, though many false witnesses came forward. At last, two came forward and said, "This man said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days.'" And the high priest stood up and said, "Have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you. But Jesus remained silent. I wasn't sure exactly what label to put on this, but I'm going to call it political power. And it is simply the power to persuade people and make them follow you. And this is what those who had Jesus on trial here were obsessed with. The very reason that they paid Judas to betray him, the very reason that they convened this illegal trial in the middle of the night before the Sanhedrin, because according to Jewish law, trials had to be in the day, the very reason they rigged this whole thing and brought in false witnesses who nevertheless couldn't agree among themselves and they couldn't find a legal reason to convict him, was that they were afraid they were going to lose their political power. This may be the most tempting kind of power that's out there. Because as human beings, we want the support of other human beings. We want people around us who will tell us, you're the bomb, you know, we're listening to you, we're going to follow you. It makes us feel like we've got something. And so you've got all 72 of, well, actually, I don't know, probably wasn't all 72 of them, but it was a sizable number of the Sanhedrin Council who were like the supreme religious authority in Israel, gathered together, and that made them feel like they had the power to try the Son of God, the Messiah, to convict him of blasphemy. But spiritual battles are not won by willpower, they're not won by physical power, and they're not won by political power. Convincing people to support us, to join our group, to give us more numbers, is not in the scope of our mission, and it was not, just as it was not in the scope of Jesus' mission. In fact, we can find him doing the very opposite of that. So John 6:15 says of Jesus, perceiving then that they, which is the crowds, were about to come and take him by force to make him a king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. He avoided the crowds who were trying to hand him political power. He rejected it. And far from being the kind of a leader or a teacher who tries to attract people by telling them what they want to hear, he told them exactly what they didn't want to hear. Luke chapter 14, verses 25 through 26 says, now great crowds accompanied him, that's Jesus, and he turned and said to them, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Can you imagine? I mean, I like the way Kyle Idleman put this in his book. He said, a message, the essence of which is hate your mom, is not one that's calculated to attract the maximum number of followers. Now, of course, we know there's more to it than that. But this could very easily be how people heard it. And Jesus did not try to couch it at all. He didn't even explain and say, now, when I say hate, I don't actually mean hate, of course. And he didn't mean hate in the terms of, like, having malevolence towards someone, but he didn't explain that. He essentially just gave them this stark message, crowds of people following them, and he said, if you're going to come after me, this is what you need to do. You need to hate your father, your mother, your wife, your children, and your own life, or you can't be my disciple. Was he trying to build a following? He was not trying to build a following. That was not in the scope of his mission. Now, we might get more confused about it because we are supposed to take the gospel to the nations. We are supposed to win souls. But there's a difference. There is a difference between taking the gospel to people to win them for the kingdom of God and building a following for the sake of having a following, for the sake of feeling more powerful and significant. Every time in the history of the church that the church has gotten political power, it has been bad news. Go back and look up Constantine, the Roman emperor who first legalized Christianity. That was when a lot of the heresies started coming in. That's when things started going really sideways because suddenly Christianity was acceptable. Suddenly Christians had political power and the gospel began to be corrupted. And it has happened over and over and over again because that's not what we need. We do not need, as Jesus did not need. He stood alone. He had no lawyer. He didn't say, hey, I want you to look up Joseph of Arimathea. He's a rich guy that I know. He'll come here, speak on my behalf, or talk to Nicodemus. Where's Nicodemus? He didn't try to bring in those powerful people. He stood alone, yielding himself to his Father's will. He didn't use what he could have had He rejected it. And just like Christ, we don't need to reach for that. We don't need to convince people. Paul was one of the most educated men of his day in the Jewish religion. And he also knew a lot about other religions. But he said when he came to Corinth, he said, I determined that I wouldn't know anything among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. Because he wasn't looking just to win over people's minds and get them to be followers in the cause. He wanted them to believe the gospel and to be saved. So in the meantime, as Jesus stands alone, having rejected willpower, physical power, and political power, we see the final collapse of Peter's attempts to be faithful. At least, I mean, I guess, according to the narrative, he ran with the rest, and then he kind of stopped and came back and just followed at a distance and ended up in the courtyard of the high priest. So, actually, I need to go back because I didn't read through all of this. Jesus remained silent. He did not use all the things that were available to him that he could have, all the wisdom that he could have spoken to defend himself. And the high priest said to him, I adjure you by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. Jesus said to him, you have said so. But I tell you, from now on, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Then the high priest tore his robes and said, he has uttered blasphemy. What further witnesses do we need? You have now heard his blasphemy. What is your judgment? They answered, he deserves death. Then they spit in his face and struck him. And some slapped him, saying, prophesy to us, you Christ. Who is it that struck you? I often think about Jesus knowing exactly who it was. He did. But he remained silent. He did not use the power that he had. Verse 69, now Peter was sitting outside in the courtyard, and a servant girl came up to him and said, you also were with Jesus the Galilean. But he denied it before them all, saying, I do not know what you mean. And when he went out to the entrance, another servant girl saw him, and she said to the bystanders, this man was with Jesus of Nazareth. And he denied it with an oath, I do not know the man. After a little while, the bystanders came up and said to Peter, certainly, you too are one of them, for your accent betrays you. Then he began to invoke a curse on himself and to swear, I do not know the man. And immediately the rooster crowed. And Peter remembered the saying of Jesus, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. And he went out and wept bitterly. I think that this is one of the best pictures that we're given in the scripture of what it looks like when we rely on human resolve and willpower, even to do the will of God, even to do right things. What Peter desired to do was, in fact, the right thing. He wanted to be faithful. He never thought he would come to this place. He was willing to draw his sword and die for Jesus in the garden, but there, a servant girl, not a 6'5" Roman guard that was armed to the teeth, but a servant girl made him deny his Lord. Because human beings are weak. Fundamentally, we are weak. And none of us can think that we're any better. But it's not where you want to go. You don't want to go down that road because it's grief. It is tremendous grief if you're relying on the wrong kind of power and you end up having to face your own failure, as Peter did. There was redemption for him, and we'll see some of that in a minute, but it's not the way we want it to go, that we rely on willpower or physical power or go after political power. What kind of power did Jesus have? Well, once again, I want to go back to what he didn't do. Because I think that the hardest thing in the world is to have power and not use it. And you think about in the garden when he came face to face with Judas, he could have turned him into a pillar of salt. He could have vaporized the whole crowd with all their swords and clubs that came after him with a word. Even at the end, when he hung on the cross and they said, if you're the Son of God, they mocked him and they said, if you're the Son of God, come down from the cross and we'll believe you. He could have done it. He could have come down from the cross. He could have made their mockery die on their lips as the fire of God fell from heaven and consumed them. He could have done that and we'd have all been lost. I think the hardest thing in the world, I'll say it again, is to have power and not use it. And to have the power, to have that power under control is an unimaginable thing for me. Because I know with just the tiny amount of power that I know that I have misused it in moments where I felt threatened or where I felt offended. And I had the power to say something or do something to defend myself, to make myself feel validated in that moment. I have used it. But nothing close. I mean, it's not even a comparison to the amount of power Jesus had, nor to the offense and humiliation that he was suffering at the hands of sinful people who were not worthy to be in his presence and yet slapped him and spit in his face and mocked him and tortured him and drove nails into his hands and feet. What kind of power does it take to have that power under control and to not use it when you could? It's the power of surrender. That was the power that Jesus gained in the garden that he had been cultivating all of his life when he kept saying yes to the Father and yes to the Father and yes to the Father and no to self and no to self and no to self, surrendering over and over and over again until finally in the Garden of Gethsemane he poured out his very life and he said, not my will, your will. And then there was nothing. There was nothing left for the enemy to get a hold of because it was all surrendered to God. It was. I want to read lastly a scripture from Peter. Because one of the things I love about Peter is how the story of his life is a story of such restoration. Because even though he did rely on the wrong kind of power, even though he failed very publicly and catastrophically, he was restored. And better than anyone else, he knew what kind of power Jesus had. He knew how Jesus made it through the most horrific trial that any person has ever been subjected to in the history of the world. And that is how he himself had the strength to die, much as Jesus died, at least according to tradition, except that he didn't want to be crucified in the same way as the Lord, so they crucified him upside down. Before his death, and he knew his death was imminent, he knew that Jesus had told him that was in fact the very way he was going to die. So he lived his life knowing that that suffering was ahead of him. And he wrote to people who were suffering for the gospel's sake. And this is what he said in 1 Peter chapter 2, beginning with verse 18. Servants, be subject to your masters with all respect, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the unjust. You know how hard it is to submit to someone who is unjust? It is galling. I mean, it's bad enough to humble ourselves under a just authority, but what about an unjust authority? That's what Jesus did. Those who had been given power over him by the Father, he allowed to mistreat him and to do evil. Verse 19, for this is a gracious thing, when mindful of God, one endures sorrows while suffering unjustly. Peter witnessed that firsthand when he saw Jesus suffer and die for sins he had not committed. For what credit is it if when you sin and are beaten for it, you endure? But if when you do good and suffer for it, you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example so that you might follow in his steps. He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. I want to zoom in on that word entrusted. It says he continued entrusting himself. That is the same word that is used to describe Jesus' betrayal. All throughout the Gospels, when he said, I'm going to be betrayed, when it talks about Judas betrayed him, when the Jews handed him over to the Romans, when Pilate handed him over to be crucified, it's the same word as is used right here. The only reason Jesus could be handed over by others is because he had handed himself over to God. Because he had surrendered himself to God, he was able to endure being handed over to suffering and death without using the power that he had to stop it. This is the power of surrender. People that are following in Jesus' steps and are surrendered in this way cannot be stopped. I've used this example before, but I often think of it. Years ago, we liked to play these strategy board games, and they would simulate infantry combat. And they talked about how people don't realize that most attacks are repelled not because the soldiers are killed, but because they run, because they're trying to save their lives. It's a human instinct for survival. So you don't necessarily have to kill all the enemy troops. You just got to make them fear and run. But there was a particular kind of situation. This was simulating World War II infantry combat. In a very rare situation, Russian units, because this had been known to happen in real life, they would go, it was called going berserk. And in that scenario, you couldn't chase them off. The only way they could be stopped was by killing them. Full surrender to God gives you that kind of power. Believe me, I've played the game, it's a very powerful unit. If you can't chase them off and they're just coming straight at you, that's very powerful. If you had a whole army like that, nobody could stop them. You'd have to kill every single one of them. Jesus said, the prince of this world, referring to Satan, comes and he has nothing in me. Why not? Why didn't he have anything in Jesus? Because it was already all surrendered. Satan comes to you and he says, I'm going to ruin your reputation. I've already surrendered my reputation to God. I'm going to take your health. I've already surrendered my health to God. I'm going to take your family. I'm going to take your possessions. I've already surrendered all those to God. You're already surrendered. What's he going to take from you? There isn't anything. All he can do is kill you. And your life is already surrendered to God too. That is the power that Jesus had. That's how he made it through when the disciples failed. That's how he remained faithful. Is that he kept, as Peter said, and he saw it, he was there, he knew, he kept entrusting himself to the one who judges righteously. It's faith. It's belief that in the end, God is the judge and everything is going to be made right. No one is ever going to get away ultimately with anything. And those who have walked in obedience to God will receive their reward. If we really believe that and if we really know that, it can carry us through. If we, as Jesus did, continually surrender ourselves to the one who judges righteously.